Good day. My name is Blake McVeigh, and welcome to another edition of Book Talk. Today's author is John T. Edge. He is the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance at the University of Mississippi, and among other titles, he has written Southern Belly, A Food Lover's Companion, and A Gracious Plenty, Recipes and Recollections from the American South. He has written the book The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. The work links traditional Southern foods and foodways to pivotal historical events in the American South since the 1950s. It spans from Jim Crow issues, such as lunch counter access for African Americans, through the Back to the Land movement of the 1970s, the move of Southern foods to fast food franchises, and more, all the way up to the current trend of including into the Southern pantheon of foods those from immigrants' home countries, such as Mexico or Vietnam. Mr. Edge, thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
You clearly researched and wrote widely, not only for this book, but for your others. Mm-hmm. Do you feel boxed in at all when someone refers to this as a food book?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I write about food because I think writing about food gives me access to writing about racism and class difference and gender inequity, all those things that trouble and rankle the South, and as is really clear right now, trouble and rankle the whole dang country. So writing about food isn't limiting to me. Writing about food, it's a way to kind of focus my attention and focus my It's like putting blinders on, but when you put the blinders on, you actually see more clearly. You see the possibilities in the study of one particular field. So, no, it doesn't limit me at all.
Why would you link food to civil rights or other controversial issues at all?
If you think about the most intimate acts in which we humans engage, sex and food, we eat a lot more often, at least I do. It's worthy of study. If we're going to deny the study of food, we're denying this great facet of our culture. If we deny the study of food, we're ignoring this kind of bedrock activity of our beings. By writing about and thinking about food, especially in the 1950s and 1960s, you begin to recognize that restaurants were kind of battlegrounds during that moment. I mean, just start there. Start with the most ready example, which is the lunch counter sit-ins that were ignited in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1960, in February of 1960. If you unpack that moment, you know, yes, it was about who got to sit down at a lunch counter and order apple pie and the apple pie actually be delivered to them. But it was also symbolic. It was also about humanity in a big picture sense. And the fact that that struggle was framed by time in a restaurant tells us one of the ways in which food means and one of the ways in which restaurant going is about more than going to get food.
So in a sense, you're saying because it is a universal experience, there's probably no more natural place to start such important discussions than
food.
Yeah,
restaurants and food culture are not just soft-focused, gauzy things to think about. It's not all about hearth and home and mama and grandmama. Restaurants are unique sites of inequity. Again, that's something that's quite evident today and is evident in the 1950s, 1960s as well. So in the same way that we study literature or we study music as outputs of people in place, and if we want to understand Memphis and look at Stax and other incubators for new definitions of the South, we've long recognized that musicians helped shape our worldview and helped shape, you know, what we might have thought of in the 1960s as a kind of resistance to Jim Crow, the way we talk about resistance today. In the same way that we think and talk about food, in the same way we think and talk about music, we also should and can think and talk about food and think and talk about literature. They're all cultural outputs or ways to understand people in place. And that's what's accessible to me when I write and think about food.
So you could say, or sounds like in a way you are saying, that whether it's a restaurant or somebody's kitchen who is open to others or somebody's church kitchen, that it's really a form of our public square.
Sure. I mean, you know, our public square can be a messy place, you know? Our public square is another one of those things that we think of in this kind of becalmed way. We think of in this idealized way, you know, where unrelated people relate as equals and you cross paths and you begin a conversation. But rancor happens in the public square too. Rancor happens in restaurants. Rancor happened in restaurants in the 1960s.
Definitely. The New York Times says your book is a powerful and provocative voice for Southern food. Does Southern food have more of a voice than other regional cuisines in the U.S.?
Yeah, and I think that is because the narratives embedded within Southern food, the narratives embedded within fried chicken and barbecue, those kind of totemic Southern foods, are more complex in the South, are more controversial in the South, and that is all tied up in the legacy of slavery and the aftermath of Jim Crow. The South doesn't have a lock on regional distinctiveness, and Southern food doesn't have a lock on regional distinctiveness. A lot of the attributes we apply to Southern food culture are really about rural food culture, or were. The Midwest does really well by fried chicken, too. The kind of eastern parts of the Midwest do really well by barbecue. So we don't have a lock on that. I would argue that today, the Southwest and the border territories, the Southwest especially, are deeply important food zones to understand and to think about. And yet, I come back to this notion that the imprint of racism, the imprint of enslavement on the South defined Southern food, it Africanized Southern food, and the reverberations of that going through centuries now continue to make our food different and make the issues that surround our food more important to ponder both for us as Southerners and for the nation. I'm getting on a soapbox kind of, but, you know.
With the Potlicker Papers in the first section of the book, you write about politicians of the day in the 1950s and 60s who were sympathetic to the civil rights movement and how their love of Southern food put them in contact with those who helped progress the movement, such as how President Kennedy would patronize the work of Georgia Gilmore. How widespread was this sort of practice in which a white person of power would patronize the underground black economy?
It wasn't that common. I mean, the restaurants that women like Georgia Gilmore ran in Montgomery, Alabama, were very much that. They were a part of the underground economy, and they were places of succor and safety for black activists. And because of that, they also attracted sympathetic or politically astute white members. You know, one of the great appeals to this that crosses over racial divides is that the food of black and white Southerners has far more in common than it has differences. People who want to parse out differences between Southern food and soul food, if you want to choose those two kind of groupings, parsing those out, saying that they're very different things, is a false enterprise, I think. The cultural milieu that surrounds those foods, you know, soul food and the naming of it linked to the Black Power movement and the moment of soul power, soul brother, all that, defines it in different ways. The people who cook it define themselves in different ways. But one of the reasons you find that kind of backdoor patronage of white power brokers and black restaurants is because the food appeals, the food communicates, and because by walking in the back door of that black restaurant, the white power broker gains access to not only the food they love, but they gain a different kind of power, and they can come and go quite easily because of the power they wield.
So in the next section of the book, you talk about how Southern food went nationwide, fast food, franchises, Kentucky Fried Chicken and others. Was there any kind of link between this underground black business network and this move toward nationwide franchising, or was it kind of taken over by others?
The fast food enterprise of the 1970s, Minnie Pearl, emerged out of Nashville in the 1970s, Minnie Pearl's fried chicken, and so did Mahalia Jackson's fried chicken. Mahalia Jackson's began in 1971 in Memphis. One of the initial presidents of that company was Benjamin Hooks, and I believe this library might be named for that gentleman. And there's this beautiful moment in the early 1970s when, if you think about the 60s, when restaurants and lunch counters in the South were tainted. You know, restaurants and lunch counters were places where blood was spilled over the integration of those spaces. And they were tainted by that history. And here comes a new form of food, fast food, that arrives without that taint. It's new, it's modern, it's seemingly deracinated. Now, whether that's true or not is a whole other issue, but seemingly deracinated. And here comes this enterprise out of Memphis led by African-American business people and veterans of the civil rights movement who say things like, we are black businessmen after white money. We still want to control the enterprise, but we're after business relationships, not plantation ships. I mean, the language is beautiful, acute, focused, fantastic. And so much of that begins here in Memphis with the notion that you can grow the black economy through fast food, through franchising of fast food. And you see, there's this great picture that opens the introduction to my book, and it's a picture of Russell Sugarman, was an attorney here in Memphis, gone to Harvard Law, comes back to Memphis, was active in the Memphis sanitation workers' strike. You see this picture of Russell Sugarman and Mahalia Jackson, and they're announcing the groundbreaking for the first Mahalia Jackson in Memphis. And they're talking about the promise of black wealth by way of fast food, by way of fried chicken, through the story and the legacy of Mahalia Jackson. Like, those two points where food, the promise of the future, black life, and black wealth, where those intersect, they intersect in Memphis in a fascinating way.
When you look broader in Southern culture, could you get a sense of how other Southerners viewed these? Did they feel like these franchises watered down the product at all? Did they feel any sense of betrayal or, well, that's not real Southern fried chicken?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is that, and I think Southerners tend to tell themselves stories about Southern traditional forms. You know, they tend to dismiss updates of fried chicken or biscuits and say, you know, that's not traditional. That's not the way my mama made it. And that's really interesting. It's kind of a fiction, because what's interesting to me about fast food, what's interesting to me about pressure cooked fried chicken like Colonel Sanders introduced, you know, first to Kentucky and then to the world, and biscuits, you know, which become kind of drive-through food in the 1970s. So those foods, fried chicken and biscuits adapted for the modern era, they're really a reflection of the way we move as Southerners from rural to urban and from urban to suburban. These are adaptations to suit traditional consumers. They still want to eat their fried chicken, but it's going to be pressure fried and it's going to be sold by Colonel Sanders. They still want their biscuits, but the biscuits are rolled out by Hardee's and sold through the drive-thru. But the tethers are really important here. The tether from the past to the present, and the ability to still sustain yourself on this food that feels and tastes and looks a lot like your past. That tether from past to present is really important.
Is there a link between this kind of disdain about that ain't the way mama made it?
Right.
Is there any link between that attitude and the renaissance that started to come around in the 90s and a little beyond, this you know, back to the earth and
Southern food, you know, begins this renaissance in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, one of the archetypes of that was Jose Gutierrez here in Memphis at Chez Philippe. I still remember going there, and I relate this in the book, you know, getting grits couscous at Chez Philippe in like 1995, something like that. I mean, he wasn't alone, right? You know, so Gutierrez was reviving and reinterpreting Southern food. And that effort began in the mid-80s and gained momentum by the 90s, and it was a rehabilitation of the South. It really was. It was, let's tell a new story about the South. Let's cook new food that reinterprets the old ways. And that shows up in the cooking of someone like Gutierrez. It shows up, the real kind of proponent that we regard now in that way is someone like Frank Stitt at Highlands Bar and Grill in Birmingham. You know, he arises in the early 1980s, you know, not that many years after Birmingham had earned its acclaim as Bombingham. You know, it was a place that the tape loop running through your head when you think about Birmingham back then was Bull Connor's Police Dogs. And here's another answer. Here's another way of framing the South. And it's this restaurant as a kind of showcase of the South and what the future tense possibilities might look like. And a restaurant like Highlands Bar and Grill or Jose Gutierrez's work at Chez Philippe, it looks like you know, between these four walls, we can't change what's going on outside, but between these four walls, we're going to shape a new narrative about the South. And that's what this whole book is about. It's like, what are the new narratives that people shape over time about the region, and how do they use food to do that?
Kind of in the same vein, I want to backtrack a little bit and talk about some of the imagery and the marketing that was used with the whole fast food thing. Colonel Sanders in particular is one that's just kind of obvious to talk about.
Yeah.
His image, which, you know, I mean, he pretty much brings to mind an antebellum plantation owner.
White suit.
Like, was he seen as a setback by anyone, as a hearkening back to slavery?
I would imagine if you'd talked to Mr. Hooks in that moment, Reverend Hooks in that moment, I believe he might have thought about it that way. And we can regard Colonel Sanders that way. Now, we recognize the way that he was selling a plantation South, right? The white jacket, he bleached his goatee. He took on this plantation de rigueur look. It's pretty transparent, the intent. Would people have recognized that in the 1970s? I don't think it would have been so evident. I think now it's pretty naked what the associations were. There were this whole gamut of what I call kind of pageant restaurants that emerged in the 1970s in cities like Atlanta, wherein women wore hoop skirts and young black men strapped the menu across their chest to sing-song the menu. These were kind of pageants that were staged for the South, acting out these kind of old South ideas, and restaurants were one of the places that came forward. I can see a direct connection between those kind of restaurants and the emergence of Colonel Sanders. Yeah, yeah.
So what do you make of this recent renaissance of Colonel Sanders?
I think it's problematic for all those reasons. I think, you know, remember 4 or 5 years ago, KFC had him as a hip-hop character. There was a brief moment of Colonel Sanders as hip-hop character. It was troubling. I think this Colonel Sanders as plaything of pop culture is at its core a troubling phenomenon, because if you recognize from whence he came, and there's no doubt from whence he came, and now you want to revive him and make him funny, and you're, you know, like your uncle who's had a few too many drinks and sits in the corner and says slightly racist things, that's the way he comes off to me, and I can't shake that.
It's like playing with a symbol of oppression.
Yeah. It's toying with one, and it's toying with our recollections, and it's normalizing that plantation outfit.
I feel like it's got to be very similar to the whole controversy about replacing Colonel Reb down at the University of Mississippi.
Yeah.
And that was a real hot-button issue for a while. Probably still is with certain people.
With certain people, but, you know, they're quieting as time goes on. You know, that kind of plantation garb signals something. And if you don't understand what that is broadcasting, then you're willfully not paying attention.
You use a particular term in the Potlicker Papers, gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us know what that is in regards to urban planning. But in regards to food, what do you mean when you use gentrification?
I think we devalued our food culture for the longest time. We devalued it because food was a product of people of color. They were the farmers, they were the artisans, they were the barbecue pit masters, they were the fried chicken cooks. We devalued our food culture because women were in charge of kitchens. At least that was the sense in popular culture. And so for the longest time, we devalued food as a cultural product because it was linked to women, because it was linked to people of color. There's been, over the last 20 years, by way and messages delivered by way of restaurants and chefs, that food is worthy of respect. And you think about a chef like Sean Brock, about whom I write in this book, who made his name in Charleston, South Carolina, and now lives in Nashville and has 4 Husk restaurants across the South now. He gentrified Southern food, and that comes with some problematic realizations, but it also comes with some upside in that we devalued this food for so long. Now we build value again in it by way of telling new stories about it. And I can see a link between Sean building a new value in Southern food and a musician like Brittany Howard of the Alabama Shakes taking new pride in her home region of Alabama. You know, you look at Brittany Howard perform on the stage in a sundress and you see this big old tattoo of the state of Alabama on her arm. And she's saying, this is my place. She's actively claiming the place. And in a bunch of different ways, a bunch of different Southerners are claiming the South again. And they're not claiming it as a white place or a black place. They're not claiming it, certainly, from a Jim Crow stance. They're claiming the South and saying, we made this together, black and white. And now we made this together, black, white, brown, many hues. That to me is exciting. And that's a kind of gentrification that, again, comes with some issues. But I see new value being instilled in our cultural outputs, from food to music to literature, all of it.
So as you talk about Southern food, Southern culture, is there one marker in particular that signaled a shift for Southern food into a position of respectability? Something that took the limelight on a broader scale?
Yeah, I mean, here we sit in Memphis, and I think it's appropriate to talk about barbecue that way. You know, when Danny Meyer opens the restaurant Blue Smoke in New York City, you know, Danny Meyer, kind of the signal American restaurateur, the guy who made his name with Union Square Cafe and with Gramercy Tavern, the guy who became America's restaurateur, when Danny Meyer, who grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, a barbecue town, when Danny opens a barbecue restaurant on 27th Street, I can't remember the exact, in the 20s in New York, and says, this is great American food and it is worthy of a New York City showcase. That was a moment of maturity for America's relationship with Southern food and America's relationship with barbecue. And Danny Meyer said, like, listen, we're not going to be a barbecue joint. We're going to be a showcase of American regional barbecue styles. And this food, which too often America is associated with poverty, tumble-down shacks, and impoverished people. Yes, people who grew up in challenging economic circumstances have long been the best practitioners of barbecue. But that need not be the sole way we tell this story. Those barbecue pitmasters are worthy of this kind of pedestal that I'm going to build in New York. I want to tell their story in New York City. I think that moment when he opens that restaurant opens up, again, like this idea of gentrification and broader Southern food. It offers some challenges because who's telling the story? Is this white guy from St. Louis, Missouri? Or is it going to be an African-American pitmaster like J.C. Hardaway of Memphis, Tennessee? I remember the first time I walked into Blue Smoke in New York City, there's a picture of J.C. Hardaway on the wall immediately to my right. So it's beautiful that Danny Meyer is paying homage to him. He pulled that image from Frank Stewart's photographs in Lola's Eric Eli's book, Smokestack Lightning. So there's great connectivity and communication there. I think it's an important moment. It comes with some complexities because ultimately it's a white man controlling that story. Just as I sit here, a white man telling this story.
What has brought about the popularity of foods that an outsider would not typically associate with the South, such as tamales or Vietnamese chicken wings?
Demographics have brought about that. I think that by way of the rates of immigration, the numbers aren't as big here in the South as they are, say, in California or Southwest Texas, but the rates of immigration, the rates of change in the South are great. If you want to look honestly at what workaday food is in the South now, if you want to look at what the 21st century meat and three is or what the 21st century barbecue joint is, the 21st century meat and three is a Thai restaurant owned by mom and pop. The 21st century barbecue joint is a barbacoa trailer by the side of the road somewhere between Memphis and Jackson, Tennessee, owned by, a first-generation immigrant who came to work a chicken plant and stayed and began cooking by the side of the road just like an African-American pitmaster might have done two generations before. If you choose to look honestly at the South, who we are today, who's cooking our food, who's cooking working-class food in the South, it's hard not to come to that conclusion that Mexican-American, Vietnamese-American, Korean-American, Chinese-American, immigrant Americans are the flag flyers, the banner wavers of Southern food for the future.
So as I was looking at some of the reviews and such, I came across the term a couple of different times about an accepted narrative about Southern cuisine and how you are challenging that narrative. Do you know what that accepted narrative is that they're talking about? And have you intentionally challenged it, or is it just something that's just kind of happened?
I think that the stories that we Southerners, black and white, have told about the South, especially the stories that white Southerners have chosen to tell about the South, have limited this place. Especially the stories white Southerners have told of moonlight and magnolias that have erased black accomplishment and put white accomplishment at the center have hurt the South, have knocked us in the ditch, as it were. And I think it's my responsibility as a writer, thinking about food, to tell a new story, to tell an old story in a new way. And that story attempts to pay down this kind of debt of pleasure to working class cooks who didn't get their due. And this isn't all about African American cooks. These are working class white cooks, too. You know, we didn't value food culture for those reasons I talked about before, because it was the work of women, because it was the work of people of color. And yet, we think of food as a signal product of the South. We take great pride in it. If you're on a plane to Memphis, you know, you can hear, I hear every time I'm flying back home, I hear somebody talking about where they're going to go eat barbecue. And it's usually somebody from New York or from Chicago or something like that. They're obsessed with this. And it's our responsibility, my responsibility as a storyteller and writer, to help them understand the cultural roots of that and to tell a true as possible story about where this food comes from, the adversity that is bundled within it, and the heroes like Georgia Gilmore, the cook from Montgomery, Alabama, who fed the civil rights movement and fed the Montgomery bus boycott, to tell those stories and say, if you love Southern food, here's the narrative you're really buying. You're buying the crunch and you're buying the smokiness and you're buying the savor of Southern food. But what you're really reacting to, I think, are all those stories we've told through time. And it's my job to tell some new stories.
You talk in particular about one restaurant that was a whites-only restaurant. Mm-hmm. It was like a KKK restaurant.
These were the upper middle class. This was the Citizens Council, not the Klan.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it's not funny, but it's true. I mean, it's a point of distinction, and it's important.
I guess what I'm getting at is, how do you think someone of that mindset might view the work you're doing?
So this restaurant about which we're talking is Lusco's in the Mississippi Delta in Greenwood. I have a good relationship with the owners of that restaurant, the Pinkston family. What happened in that restaurant and the waiter who worked there, Booker Wright, I think his story of resistance, his story of truth-telling, is one of the most important to come out of the civil rights movement era, much less a story about food. I think of all the stories that come out of the civil rights movement era, his is one of the most heroic. In conversation with the Pinkstons, I believe they recognize that. They take issue with how he is depicted and whether he was appreciated in that restaurant or underappreciated, whether he was free in that restaurant, whether he was fired from his job. There's this range of things that we disagree on. But was he an important figure? Did his moment in 1965, interviewed by NBC News, where he said, you know, I wait on white folks, this is what it's like, and then he pivots halfway through to speak the truth. You know, he'd been telling this kind of Janus-faced lie about what it was like to be black in America, and then he tells the truth. That was a signally important moment, and a waiter delivered that message in a way that I think no one else has done as well. Can we all agree that his testimony in that moment was deeply important and affecting? It's hard, if you watch that 3 minutes of videotape, I really can't imagine anyone who watches that and hears his voice crack and hears him speak so clearly and so candidly about what he wants for his children to come. If you watch that and you don't understand that that was a deeply flawed moment and his relationship to his white patrons was predatory and horrible to endure, something's missing.
One writer said, you are an ecumenist navigating various culinary crises. Do you ever at all consider your work in religious language like that?
No.
Or any religious themes? Has that ever occurred to you?
No. No. I don't even know what to make of that statement. What do you make of that?
I was a little puzzled myself. The way I took it was, you just described some of it. You are hopping from one camp to another. Not only can you go to New York City and visit a barbecue restaurant, interview, you know, pitmasters of various places, but you can also go to the restaurant in Greenwood.
Right.
You can talk to and you can navigate all of these disparate opinions and traditions within Southern culture and kind of put it in a way that someone like me can read and make some sense of it all. That's the way I took it. I don't know if that is what was intended.
I mean, you know, I really appreciate that because I wanted to write a book about the South that uses food as a way to understand the South. So I didn't want to write a book about Southern food. I didn't want to, you know, there are a lot of people who've written really fine books that look at, you know, like my friend Adrian Miller wrote a book about soul food that examines it ingredient by ingredient, kind of dish by dish. It was a really smart way to organize it, but I wanted to write a book. I mean, I've got a master's degree in Southern studies from the University of Mississippi. It's kind of how I learned to write and think about my region. And I wanted to write about the region and use food as a way to do it, not write about food. That's what interests me. Like I can remember being in this library more than a decade ago, going through the vertical files for information about Piggly Wiggly, realizing that his story and the story of the birth of Piggly Wiggly was, yeah, it's a story of marketing. It's a story of aspirational promise for the middle class. It's a story of Memphis as this incubator of oddity. You know, it's all these beautiful stories. And it's a little bit about food, not a lot.
And you mentioned a little bit earlier on, America is more divided these days than it has been in a while. Is there a role that food can play in helping bridge that divide?
I think I got accustomed to talking about food that way. And probably did talk about food that way until very recently. And I talked about food in a kind of kumbaya way. You know, I talked about, you know, this the metaphor of the table and the idea of the welcome table and the possibilities of breaking bread and breaking down barriers across the table. Like you and I sit here to, you know, if there was food here, you know, that would be a great facilitator of dialogue between the two of us. And I do believe that sharing food with someone, it comes back to the, you know, earlier comments we made, that there's this humanity expressed in that moment. The other thing I've come to realize, though, is that restaurants, especially public dining, is a site of unique inequity, too. So restaurants and food culture, in a larger sense, holds this possibility of bringing people together. And yet, food culture, what goes into it, the way workers are treated in the fields, the way that working class people have had to subsist on a lesser diet and are now subsisting on diets that, by way of a surfeit of calories, lay waste, that by way of our food system and by way of especially our industrial food system, food is a problem too. So food is, there's this promise of solace and redemption in food, and restaurants are sites of unique inequity. I write in this book about Paula Deen and her mistreatment of Dora Charles, an African-American woman who worked in her kitchen for decades. And I think you can make a direct linkage between that kind of racially grounded mistreatment in the kitchen to the revelations of late about gender-based inequities and mistreatment in kitchens. Kitchens are tough places. Kitchens are places where beautiful food is created and rancor is festered.
Just as you were talking right there, I think of other things like, I won't bake a cake for this segment of population.
Right.
Or I'm going to boycott this particular brand or this particular franchise
right.
because their political stance is this or that or
right.
the other. So I guess we will just leave open the question, can food help save America in 2018?
I think it reflects America. I think that's the thing. I mean, you know, it's like food is the rock and roll of the 21st century. Like it's how you broadcast your morals. It's how you say who you are. It is by choosing to eat particular food, not eat particular food, by choosing to eat in particular restaurants and not eat in particular restaurants, by choosing to bake a cake for someone or not bake a cake for someone. Good Lord, help me. You know, that expresses your morals, your beliefs, and food is kind of the meme of the moment to do that.
So Southern food in 2018, a bit of a two-pronged question.
Sure.
Where do you feel like the conversation needs to go regarding Southern food and where do you see it going, regardless of how we want to describe it?
I think two things are happening right now. There's a kind of reinvestment in local and appreciation of local, and that's going to continue apace. Food systems will embrace local and make it easier for everyone to use local ingredients. That's going to happen. We're also going to, I think, continue to see this kind of immigrant influence wherein we redefine what Southern food is. Those are both things that I want to happen and I see happening. What do I want to happen? This is kind of selfish because I wrote a book wherein I argue that we're really buying into narratives when we buy food. I want people to understand these narratives embedded within food. I want them to think about food as a cultural product. I want them to recognize and appreciate cooks and farmers and artisans. And I want them to see those people as kind of standard bearers of our culture.
What about food deserts? It is so ironic that, you know, of course, that's not an exclusively Southern phenomenon, but there definitely is irony in that at one time the South was the breadbasket. It was largely agrarian. There still is a heavy agrarian element, but 50, 100 years ago, do you think anyone would have ever imagined that there would be such a thing as food deserts in the South?
But if you think about the way, say, in the Mississippi Delta, the way cotton would have been planted, you know, fence row to fence row, you'd get the tiniest little patch to raise crops for yourself. I mean, industrial ag has limited the South in so many ways. So I don't think we had a term for food deserts before. I think we're recognizing by way of that term, that elegant term, problems that have been festering for a long time.
That's a good point, that it does sound kind of elegant to say food desert, but really we're talking about people who are hungry.
We're talking about people who are hungry. We're really talking about people who are malnourished, right? So it's not really about hunger. It's about malnourishment, not only a lack of calories, but oftentimes the wrong sorts of calories.
Which is not a new problem, is it?
It isn't, but, you know, it is a different sort of problem. You know, some of the experiments in new ways of addressing malnourishment that began in the Mississippi Delta, you know, were taken nationwide. You know, in the 1960s, you had doctors prescribing food for malnutrition, which is just mind-blowing, and it sounds so bold. And you see more recently some progressive nonprofits adopting the same thing in the 2010s. But I don't see a lot of knowledge that says, hey, this happened in the Mississippi Delta. The Tufts Delta Health Clinic in Mambayo was doing that in the 1960s.
I remember having a thought very similar to that as I read that portion of the book, thinking, wow, you know, I mean, I've heard of people talking about that very recently. You know, certain diet fads are supposed to be, you know, great at addressing certain health issues and things of that nature. So it was surprising.
It's bold. And that's one of the things that I hope people take away from this book, too, is that we've talked a lot about kind of food as a problem and the problems of the South, but so many brilliant solutions to American problems have come out of the South, and so many brilliant solutions to American food problems have come out of the South. That Tufts Delta Health Clinic and the idea of food as prescription comes out of the 1960s. In the 2000s, out of the tomato fields of Florida comes a coalition of Immokalee workers, which changes how agricultural laborers are paid and pulls them up out of poverty. And that kind of solution, which was reified ultimately when Walmart, an Arkansas company, signs on to the edicts that the coalition of Immokalee workers in Florida developed. That's a great example of a problem of mistreatment of farm laborers, a solution that was gestated in the South in Florida, and a solution that was reified when Walmart signs on to their way of treating farm workers. So it's an American problem solved in the South.
John T. Edge is the author of The Potlucker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South, which is now available in paperback from Penguin Books. Blake McVeigh was your host today, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.